It's foretold by Calogero. Most Bronx tales don't end well, especially when your own country treats you like an infidel. It's eyes that need inswell. Don't box me into a corner. I float like a butterfly, sting like Muhammad. I on training day I go too hard. Ask Antoine Fuqua. I am Godzilla of these favelas. New car, flow.
Welcome to the first NBA Finals edition of your Triple Threat podcast. I am Jabari Davis, and I'll be joined by Jameson Wilson, Jordan Buscarini once again this week. We missed last week, but that was my fault. I had a birthday, and while Jameson has one coming up this week with the NBA Finals and everything, this is pretty much a great time of year for all of us. Obviously, whether you pick the Warriors or Cavs in this series, you'd like to see basketball being played at the highest level, at least in this matchup. In game one, while Golden State had some key performances from some rotation pieces, with Curry and Klay combining to go just 8 of 27 from the field, Jameson, I'll come to you first. Is this just a matter of them being overmatched, or do you think that they'll be able to kind of rectify this in game two?
Well, part of it is that, Golden State is a better overall team. You have guys that you know what you're going to get out of. That when Iguodala comes in the game, you know what he's going to provide. When Livingston comes into a game, you know what he's going to provide. With Cleveland's bench guys, with their bench, you really don't know what you're going to get. You don't know if you're going to get guys that come off the bench hitting, or if they're not, if their shot's not falling, what are they going to provide? And the same thing with J.R. Smith. Bill Simmons actually tweeted it out that, a team that has to depend on J.R. Smith is kind of a trouble because, that's the guy he should be starting as best role, should be playing 35 minutes a night and starting on a team in the finals, but that's where the Cavs are right now in the Eastern Conference. You can get away with that, but versus a superior team, you're going to have problems. So we'll see what goes on. But for right now, I think Golden State Warriors are the better overall team, and they have guys that you can consist on. But besides that, this is a better matchup for the Warriors than it was last year's versus OKC. OKC was probably the worst matchup possible. This is a much more favorable matchup for the Warriors. And the one guy that benefits more than anybody is Draymond Green. He's the guy that's able to do the things he does to make him so effective and so good in this league in terms of being able to rebound, push, defend the goal, being able to be the better big in the series, because in the other series he wasn't the best big on the court. And this series you can make a case that he's probably the best big, that's playing the four or the five in this series. So right now the Warriors are in really good shape.
And, keeping it with you just really quickly, what about the adage, what about the line of thought that everybody came into the series saying, it couldn't be set up any better for LeBron? This is, he's got his full complement of, of pieces around him this year, no excuses. What about that? I mean, I don't want to overreact to simply, one game in a series, but like you, I look at this as a favorable matchup for Golden State as well. It's a reason why I felt confident about picking them going into the series. But what about that? If you're LeBron, what are you thinking about?
Well, if you're LeBron, you're thinking about maybe slowing the pace down, because the only way to beat Golden State, you're not gonna outrun them. Like, that's just not gonna happen. I don't get what Tyronn Lue is trying to establish here when he makes these comments that we have to, push the pace and shoot and make more threes. I don't understand that, because the blueprint to give Golden State problems is to slow the game down, win the battle of the boards, don't turn over as much, and try to, keep the score low. It's a weird thing when I hear the coach thinking doing the opposite. So LeBron, he understands, he controls the game, pretty much better than anyone else in the league, I believe, at this point in time. So he knows how the game is played. I think he has to figure out what the coaching staff say, hey, we got to slow things down and try to muck up the game, because if we try to get in the track with these guys, this is going to be over in four games.
Jordan, speaking of, intriguing tactics by Tyronn Lue and his staff, what adjustments do you make if you're the Cleveland Cavaliers? I mean, we know at the end of the day, talent wins and loses ball games out there, but coaches can really impact the series with adjustments along the way. What do you do if you're Lue?
The adjustments in this series are going to be very difficult for Tyronn Lue. If you look at the most effective lineup for the Cleveland Cavaliers, and again, everyone's bringing up the fact that LeBron has Kyrie and he's got Kevin Love back. And trust me, I love both of those guys. I think Kyrie is one of the most difficult players in the league to guard one-on-one. I put him right up there with Dame Lillard. You look at Kevin Love, I think he's a phenomenal rebounder. However, the most effective lineup for the Cleveland Cavaliers in the postseason, which has been a tremendous run up to this point, is when they have LeBron, Channing Frye, Shumpert, Dellavedova, and Richard Jefferson out on the court. And it's interesting because you're surrounding LeBron James with four guys that can shoot the ball, that have shot the ball very well throughout the postseason. So when Tyronn Lue says you got to pick up the pace, we got to hit more three-point shots, that's what's been working for Cleveland throughout the postseason. The problem is it's easy to outshoot the likes of Detroit. It's easy to outshoot the likes of Atlanta and maybe not necessarily Toronto every night, but on most nights, and that's exactly what happened. So for me, the lineup that is most effective for the Cleveland Cavaliers is really taking Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving out of the equation. Now, I'm not saying that you can't be effective with those two guys on the court, but if you look from an offensive production standpoint, that's when the Cavaliers have really hurt teams. And you look at that lineup on paper and you say, what in the world? So really, if you're getting any sort of production out of your starting unit, which has J.R. Smith, as you guys alluded to once already, you need to turn to that lineup coming off of the bench. And if they're hitting on all cylinders, they're going to push Golden State offensively. Like, this series is not even remotely close to being over. I think we look at the box score, we see a 15-point Golden State win. They're coming off of three consecutive wins over OKC. This is a team that won 73 games. We know that they beat Cleveland last year. So you look at that on paper and you say, okay, well, this series, it may be over in four or five. Not yet. I still think that this Cleveland Cavalier offense has something left in the tank, and I think that you'll see a more well-balanced performance from this team offensively in game two. I mean, I don't know what adjustments you can make. I mean, you're relying on shooting the long ball all postseason, and it's worked. And we know that this is a different team in Cleveland. So if you're the Cavaliers, you just got to try to steal one game. Steal one game on the road, and then the series is in your hand, because this is a team that drastically plays better offensively at home.
Why do you think, and sticking with you for one more, why do you think it is that Cleveland, and, you know, a lot of teams are guilty of doing this, but in Cleveland in particular, when you have two, you know, I would call them supreme in terms of capability of playmakers, you know, you have two guys that can, you know, that can make plays all over the court, and Kyrie and obviously LeBron. Why do you think they rely so heavily upon isolation sets, or so many isolation sets, and seem to struggle with actually getting the other guys involved in these key moments?
I don't know if that falls on LeBron's shoulders. I mean, I really don't. I don't know the answer to that. I will say this: I love the fact that I love it when Kevin Love is inside the paint. And we saw this in game one. Kevin Love did not shoot the ball particularly well, but Kevin Love is very effective inside the paint. He's a phenomenal rebounder. And so when you're utilizing, you know, you're utilizing his strength inside the paint, I think Kevin Love is more effective. Now, it's a problem with the way, you know, you and I talked about this, Jabari, on my show earlier on in the week. LeBron wants Kevin Love out on the wing. That's where he wants Kevin Love. That's where LeBron James is most comfortable. Yet I think that Kevin Love could be a nightmare in this series for Golden State if you get him the touches inside the paint. Keep him inside 10 feet. Every now and then let him spread off on the wing. But, you know, again, a play that we saw that was very effective in the Toronto series was a play that where basically LeBron and Dellavedova are running off of the pick and roll. Channing Frye is floating around on the backside. He comes up around the short corner up to about the wing, and boom, LeBron found him for a three-point shot. In fact, I think they scored like 10 straight possessions against Toronto with that particular set. So I really don't know. This is a team where at the end of the year, if they don't get it done this season, and again, I'm not saying that this series is over, and I'm definitely not jumping the gun, but if they don't get it done, you're paying Kevin Love a whole lot of money for him to play a minimized role. And I don't think you're fully utilizing this guy. I understand why Timothy Mozgov is really just non-existent. You go back and you look at what he did in the postseason last year. It was great up until about the final three or four games of the NBA Finals. I get that. I understand that you're playing a team that plays small ball and that they're one of the greatest shooting teams that we've ever seen. I understand all that. There's just something that's not clicking. I don't know if it's a scheme. I don't know if it's how you're utilizing Kevin Love. And another thing to point out, Kyrie Irving was not that great either in game one, and I don't expect him to play like that in game one either. So when things are firing on all cylinders, it seems like this team is comfortable. Kevin Love is comfortable in a role where he's out on the perimeter launching 7-8 threes a game when it's working. Like, you go back and you look at the win in Cleveland against Toronto. When it's working, this is a cohesive group. When it's not working, it's bad basketball, and that's why you see spurts. That's why you see Cleveland down by 12, 13 points, and then all of a sudden they have a one-point lead in the third quarter only to fall back down by double digits. It works in spurts. When it's a well-oiled machine and it's working on all cylinders, they're tough to beat. They're tough to outscore.
Jordan provided the perfect, the perfect transition, because Jameson, that's exactly where I was going with it, with the Kevin Love aspect of things, and I'll open it up to you, for you to chime in on it, because he's right. We did discuss it earlier in the week on Drive Time. But why do you think it is that Cleveland has such a difficult time properly utilizing Kevin Love's offensive skill set rather than just sticking him in the corner, kind of like a glorified John Paxson or Steve Kerr, if you will?
It's tough because he's a third option. And he's a guy that once he gets the ball, he's not – like, you can't run the sets through him. Like, once he gets the ball, he's going to shoot it or try to make a move and go for the basket. The biggest thing with Kevin Love is this. They're asking him to be the third option on, like, 12 or maybe 13 shots when, he's a guy that probably, gets closer to 20 shots if you gain those shots. So it's really complicated for the kind of role he has. But also you got to realize now he has guys that can close out on him at the three-point line. So now those shots he was getting versus Atlanta and Toronto and Detroit, those shots aren't the same shots. So now he has to pass to someone else and try to go to the block. And before this series, he was not shooting that well inside the three-point area. Even though he got going a little bit in game one, still that it seemed like he's more comfortable shooting the three than he is inside the three-point line. So that's an area of concern as well for the Cavs. But to get him going, honestly, it's tough because if you go to him a couple times and he doesn't make the first couple shots, he still has to come back on defense and defend. And if we know how he defends. If, does what he does on defense and gives up a couple of buckets, now sometimes the defense can affect your offense, and now you're in a lot of trouble. So there's a lot of things with Kevin Love. It's a weird piece for them. Very good player still, but he doesn't really fit what they do to be successful in my eyes if he's not hitting a three-point shot.
Yeah, I mean, it always boiled down to, for me, and I know it's, some people will say it's revisionist history, whatever, I'll put it like this. I think Andrew Wiggins would look damn good in that lineup right now in this exact moment. But we'll let that go. What about Golden State side of things, Jameson? If you're the Warriors, how do you avoid, allowing, what's expected to be an angry Cavaliers team to come in and scrap their way to a game two upset on your home court?
Well, the thing about the Warriors is this. You have to feel really good, really confident, because your two best players didn't shoot that well, and they were still able to win by double digits. They're still able to win at home. They're still able to hold the team under 90 points. So that's a really good thing. And you have to feel that both those guys are going to play a bit better. They're going to shoot better. They're going to make shots. They're going to make tough shots. So your goal is to stay. You have to realize, hey, we have a chance to, put the foot on their throat. And also, you go back to last year, when they had a chance to win game two and they didn't, they can go back to that and say, hey, like, we know we've been in it before. We've been up 1-0. Let's go up 2-0 on the road. I think they actually will, by the way. But they have that experience to fall back on and say, hey, last year we didn't do this. Let's take care of business right now and do that. Also, I expect a better game out of both Klay Thompson and Steph Curry tomorrow as well, because they're not going to shoot that poorly, even though some of the shots were, some of the shots were bad shots, but they're not going to shoot that poorly overall. Of course, Barbosa and Livingston aren't going to have the games they had either. But when you look at the game one, you look at how poorly Steph shot, a lot of those shots are going to be there in game two, and he's going to hit some of them. We may have a similar outcome.
All right, one open one regarding Cleveland for either of you to take. What about the idea of actually, Lou mixing it up and using LeBron out of the post here and there? Now, not necessarily always looking to attack, but kind of as the catalyst to the offense with guys cutting off of him, spotting up off of him, kind of similar to how Miami used him at times.
The problem with that is this. LeBron is really good at the post, but they don't have to double him. Like, the Warriors are one of the few teams that don't have to double him. So if you don't have to double a guy, then the shooter, having him at the post, he's pretty much going to have to be an ISO situation where he's looking posting this guy up trying to score, because he's not going to be able to find guys that are shooting threes. And Cleveland doesn't cut enough. They're guys that are out there, ball watching. They don't cut to the basket enough to actually make that work well, even if that was the direction they went to. So it would be very interesting to see if that were to take place. But I don't think that's a really good idea because the Warriors, if they do double, they double late the shot clock to where they got to pass it to someone and have someone make a rush decision, which is very smart. So I don't know if that's a really good idea. I think your best bet is having LeBron maybe work out of the mid-post area so he can still see the court and still be able to make decisions while not having his back turned to defenders. Because once Golden State comes with that double late in the shot clock, makes it very difficult for Cleveland to get a quality shot in that situation.
As far as using LeBron in unique ways, I mean, the bottom line is the series, LeBron has to be the best player far and beyond. And, I, you know, the way we saw Steph and Klay Thompson play game one, in fact, I picked Klay Thompson to be the Finals MVP. I really love the way he's playing going into the NBA Finals. But LeBron has to be far and away the best player in this series. And, you know, you look at the box score, he was very close. I think he was one assist away from a triple-double, if I remember correctly, in game one.
Yeah.
So, you know, you look at the box score and you say, well, what more do you want from the guy? It needs to be more effective. It just needs to be more balanced. It needs to be a more of a LeBron takeover. And I don't know how you – I really don't know how you do that. And Jameson's right. I mean, you don't necessarily have to double-team LeBron James down low. He does need to be more assertive. He needs to be the solid number one option. I want to see LeBron James take anywhere from 25 to 30 shots. A lot of people don't necessarily believe in that. But, look, when LeBron James is at another level, when he's playing LeBron James-type basketball, it makes things easier for Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving, regardless of where they're playing, regardless of what their role is. So the Cavaliers need LeBron James to be creative. They need LeBron James to play, you know, I hate going back to it, but I mean, you brought it up yesterday, Jabari. And I mean, the way they use him during the two NBA championships that he won in Miami, it needs to be a similar role to that. I mean, get creative with him. If you want to use him down low, that's fine, but let him be the catalyst for the offense. That's exactly what they need out of LeBron in game two. And if they get game two, Cleveland's sitting in great shape.
All right, Jameson, on that note, what would a game two win by Golden State mean to you in this series, at least in your eyes? I know everybody says, you know, a series doesn't start. It's cliche, and it's really overused. But people say a series doesn't start, you know, until a road team wins. If you're Golden State and you go up 2-0 in this series, do you have the does that just multiply your confidence even more, knowing that obviously Cleveland would have to beat you 4 out of 5 going forward?
Exactly, and that's the thing. If the Warriors win games, especially they win it pretty handily, I think we're in for a short series. I think we're in for a 4 or 5 game series, just based off of this team's two. If they win game two, they're 2 games away from making history. And their confidence level. The Warriors are a team that's based off confidence. In OKC series, we saw their confidence get shook. We saw them get rattled in games 3 and 4 and whatnot. But once they got their confidence back, they were a totally different team. They go up 2-0. They're the veteran team that they are. They know what it takes to take care of business on the road. They've closed teams out on the road, and they've won big road games. If they go up 2-0, this series is all but over. It's also a situation to where they have the better team, and they have more of the advantages when you look at their rosters or the matchups. It's not like the teams are even or teams are really, really close. I think there's a pretty decent-sized gap in between the teams overall. I really think so. I really do believe so. And also, they fit. Their players fit better. So everyone understands their role, and everybody's able to play to their, you know, capability for the most part on their team. So if they go up 2-0, this series is going to be a short series. If it, on the other hand, if Cleveland wins, then we're probably in store for a 6, maybe even a 7-game series. So tomorrow's going to be very interesting, but I do think the Warriors take care of business just based off of, I think, they're just a better team.
Jordan, let's actually take the flip side of that and talk to me about what a game to win by Cleveland means in this series, especially since, if I'm not mistaken, you're of the opinion that Cleveland's going to win both games at home.
Well, I think they most certainly could win both games at home. I don't know that they will. I do believe they'll get at least one at home. You know, mm-hmm. A game two win here for Cleveland really opens up the series. The bottom line is Cleveland has to win one game at Oracle. Like, if they want to win an NBA championship, yeah, they have to win one game at Oracle. I mean, I'm stating the obvious there, but, I mean, that's a must for this team. The way I look at it for the Cleveland Cavaliers right now, and this may be that I'm really pegging Golden State as a favorite, but you want to get to game 7. Like, I don't believe that Cleveland necessarily has to close this series out before game 7 in Oracle. And I say that because, in my mind, they still have the best player in the NBA in LeBron James on their team. And so if you can get this to game 7, that's what you almost have to play for. You're going to be playing for that if you lose game 2. You're going to be playing just to survive to get it to game 7. But if you can get it to a one-game winner-take-all series with LeBron James on your side, man, you always have a chance. And even if they fall behind 2-0 in this series, what you have to do, you know, again, the old adage is, okay, well, Golden State took care of their business at home. Now we got to take care of our business. You know, it's kind of the deal of you can shorten the series. You're playing a major role as the underdog, so you do whatever you can to shorten the series. So if you can get it, that's 2 out of 3, then you play to get it to Game 7. So I don't know that it's a must win for Cleveland because you're going to have the opportunity to win 2 games at home. Yet if you are the Golden State Warriors, I mean, you could put a lot of doubt into a team like Cleveland. Now remember, LeBron has been there before. Kevin Love, Kyrie Irving, they have not been there before. Okay, so LeBron knows what it takes to win an NBA championship. He's been down in the series. If you're down 0-2 and you're going home, I just feel like there's a lot of doubt in the supporting cast mind, especially the guys like a J.R. Smith, who really is sporadic as it is right now. So you put a lot of doubt, and then you've got a rookie head coach to boot. You could really put a lot of doubt in their mind. But if you're Cleveland, like I said, you're playing to shorten the series. You almost play to get it to a Game 7, to get it to a winner-take-all. That's what the kind of underdog that they are in this series. And that's probably a roundabout way of getting there. But, I mean, at the same time, you got to play to put yourself in a situation where you're such a big underdog. You got to shorten the series. You got to find a way to do it. So you take care of your business at home. If you can eke one win out, Cleveland's in great shape because they're a tough team to beat at home.
You're absolutely right. So let me get your gut instinct. Do they pull off the upset in Game 2, or are we going back to what is Cleveland's arena called? Quicken Loans Arena. Are we going back to Quicken Loans in an 0-2 deficit?
2-0 Golden State. I don't think they get the job done in Game 2. Now, it wouldn't surprise me if they win both in Cleveland, but I think we go back to Cleveland with a 2-0 lead for Golden State.
Yeah, I agree with Jordan. I think the Warriors, they're good players. Their best two players will play well tomorrow night. And also Draymond Green, his production is going to be where it's at. You know, 17, 18 points, 10 or 11 boards, 5-6 assists type game. He's going to have that kind of game. If he's having that kind of game, they're almost unbeatable because if your third best player is impacting the game in that many areas, it's almost impossible to lose in that case. But we'll definitely see. It would not surprise me if Cleveland shot the ball well tomorrow night and stole a game, but I am picking Golden State to go up 2-0 in this series. And if they go up 2-0 in this series, I can't see this Cavs team currently constructed beating this Warriors team 4 out of 5 times to win a championship. I personally cannot. We have to see, but I personally cannot.
Well, yeah, I mean, nobody can, you know, technically say it's impossible. It just would be highly unlikely. But, you know, that's, and again, another cliche. That's why they play the games, and that's why we sit here and watch them, because, it's always fantastic to see how it breaks down. All right, even though it isn't NBA-related, I wanted to take a few moments to acknowledge the passing of one of the world's most iconic sports figures in Muhammad Ali. Whether you loved or hated Ali, and even though, and believe me, society was very much split on that for some very unfortunate reasons during his actual career, it's impossible to deny his global impact on the sporting world, social issues, and how we view our sports figures. I won't go on and on about it, but I wanted to at least give you guys an opportunity to acknowledge his passing as well, if you had anything to say.
Yes, when it comes to Muhammad Ali, he's the guy that a lot of athletes and people look back on. They think really highly of him in terms of what he stood for and whatnot, and that's kind of lost in today's age. With everyone concerned about their brand and what happened if they spoke up and whatnot. And every now and then you see little things like the I Can't Breathe T-shirts and whatnot. And that's fine, but we do need, as a whole, well, no matter what race you are, I think people need to stand up for what they feel. Instead of being afraid of what you may lose or what may happen or whatever it may be, we need more people who are important, who have a huge following, to be able to, say what they feel, especially on important issues, especially if they have good points. It's unfair that because someone makes a lot of money, they have a lot more to lose than the common person. It makes it unfortunate that they don't, let their voice be heard or their opinions be heard because they're afraid of what the backlash may be. That's very unfortunate, but that's the world we live in 2016. I don't think we'll ever have someone like this ever again. And a lot of people debate what happened and what not, when he went to jail for a few years back in the late 60s, early 70s. But we'll say this, if you believe in something, you should be able to express it however you may feel. And if you're able to live with those consequences, then that's quite all right. I don't mind that at all. I just wish more current players and more current celebrities and whatnot, the people who have the following and the power in this country, in this society, in this world. I wish they took similar things instead of always complaining or always saying no comment or always, going from pretty much, quiet on issues to really speak up. But I do want to say he wasn't in jail. He just held out from boxing. But still, just in general, it would be nice to see other athletes, especially in this current day with social media being so big, to step up and take stands on things.
As far as Muhammad Ali goes, look, rarely, and this is not being a prisoner of the moment. I mean, this is factual. So many times we get caught up in being a prisoner of the moment. Very rarely do we have an athlete that truly transcends an individual sport. Rarely does that happen. There's a handful of guys that have done that. Muhammad Ali was one of those guys to boxing. Muhammad Ali was the original self-promoter. He was the original salesman. And the thing that I love most about Muhammad Ali is the way he evolved as a human throughout his time. You know, Jabari, you hit it right on the head. A lot of people in this country were split on Muhammad Ali. We could sit here and talk about his accomplishments in boxing. I think his greatest moment in boxing was knocking out George Foreman, who happens to be one of my favorite fighters of all time. I think that was the crowning achievement for Muhammad Ali. A lot of pundits would say that they wish that Muhammad Ali would have walked away from the sport following that victory over Foreman. Look, he was one of the greatest of all time. He had a right to go out on his own terms, even though he lost 3 out of his last 4 fights. The accomplishments that he had in the ring, to me, the most epic rivalry, and this is across every sport, in my opinion,
yes,
it's Ali Frazier. That is the most epic rivalry in sports. Again, we're talking about two guys that transcended the sport, and you had two guys that they played off each other so well, and the amount of respect that they had for each other later in their lives, these volumes, as to where, you know, Muhammad Ali coming out and saying that he was wrong, he regretted some of the stuff that he said about Joe Frazier. That's where I'm getting at as far as how he evolved as a human. As a humanitarian, second to none, he had a voice. Like Jameson's talking about how he wishes more celebrities would come out. In my mind, there are very few celebrities where I want to know their opinion. Muhammad Ali was one that had the power, and it was an individual that you cared about what he thought. And that was somebody, again, when I talk about how rare these athletes are that actually transcend the sport, he's one that really did transcend it. He was one that stood up for what he believed in, but he had the power. He had the backing behind him. You knew that he was a wise man. You knew that Muhammad Ali, he was, when people say he's a hero, that's not an overstatement. He was a hero to people all over the world. So to me, he's a one-of-a-kind individual, a one-of-a-kind talent, one of the greatest fighters, boxers that we have ever seen. But I think he's going to be remembered and rightfully so for what he did outside of the ring, from taking a stand to being a humanitarian. I mean, we could sit here and talk about Muhammad Ali for days and days and days. It's truly sad. It's, it's the passing of a real American legend, and that's another term that we use way too frequently. There's only a handful of people that I am willing to attach that tag to. He is an icon, and anytime we lose an icon, it's a sad, sad day.
Absolutely. I literally could not have said it any better. You know, he's an icon. He's a legend. He's an actual global icon, not just an American icon. His imprint, it literally was felt worldwide. Here's Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Muhammad Ali, just to tie it back together a little bit. I may be 7'2", but I've never felt taller than when I was standing in his shadow. That's an all-time, and that's the end of the quote. That's an all-time great, and one of the best to ever do it in Abdul-Jabbar, just letting how significant Ali was, both as a sports and social figure. If you're under 25 and understandably, only have a memory of Ali as obviously a much more docile figure, due to the effects of Parkinson's over the last few decades, I urge you to take a few minutes to look into his story and see what he endured and was able to overcome. All right, guys, absolutely great stuff today. Let me get some final shots out of you.
Man, this is an interesting time of year right now. We have the NBA Finals. We have the pre-draft camp. All the workouts, whatnot. Basketball, it's unfortunate that the season's coming to an end. At the most, we have 6 games left. I ask everybody to enjoy it because, even though we have Summer League and the Olympics, there's nothing like NBA basketball. There is not. And we kind of take it for granted. During the regular season, we always say, oh, it's just another game in February. Oh, it's just another game in January. Well, you know what? We got a handful of games left. That's going to be it for a while. So I think people need to appreciate what we have because we have a really good game right now. I know a lot of people complain about different situations in the league and whatnot, but overall as a whole, the NBA is in a really good spot, and it's only growing and getting better. So appreciate what you have because, yes, there's some bad games in the middle of the year, but all in all, it's a really good product, and it's only getting better. So appreciate you what you have because in a couple weeks, it's going to be really, really slow on the NBA front in terms of action.
Yeah, absolutely great point. You already know, that it gets real. Obviously, we got the NBA draft coming up. At least we can, everybody can talk about that and get excited, for different, different reasons. And then you got free agency, but after that, it's real rough. Fortunately, we got Team USA this summer, but mid to late July through August is usually a tough, it's usually a tough stretch. So I agree with you. Enjoy this, enjoy this last little stretch of basketball while you got it. All right, Jordan, let me get yours.
I want to talk about the accomplishment that and this is something that we're not really fully going to appreciate until he is gone from the game of basketball. But I'm going to talk about LeBron James getting to 6 NBA Finals. Like, you got to really put that in perspective. We talked about it a little bit a couple of weeks ago. But again, this a lot of the talk about LeBron, it's not that he's gone to 6 straight finals. It's that he's 2-4 in the NBA Finals, and that if he loses, he's going to be 2-5. Let's put this in perspective here for a second. Over the course of his career, Michael Jordan won 6 NBA championships over the course of his career. You look at Kobe Bryant. He went to the NBA Finals 7 times in 20 years. That's a terrific ratio. Both of the stats I just gave out to you. Michael Jordan winning 6 and Kobe going to 7 finals in 20 years. It's a phenomenal accomplishment. Not since Magic Johnson's 9 finals in 12 years have we seen something like this. And you can go ahead and tell me that the Eastern Conference is weak, and you can go ahead and tell me that we could put Kevin Durant in that position and the Heat and the Cavaliers would be in the final 6 straight years. That's all speculation, and it's an attempt to diminish a guy that a lot of people are split on. A lot of people love LeBron. A lot of people dislike LeBron. Let's look at it for what it is. This guy has been the gatekeeper. He has been the man at the center of the NBA Finals for 6 consecutive seasons. Win or lose, teams have had to get through LeBron James, a guy that I say is the best player in the NBA right now. It's an accomplishment that really isn't getting the necessary pub. Instead, we're looking at the negative. And I understand that history is written by the winners, but guess what? He's won twice. So this isn't a Charles Barkley or Karl Malone case where when it's said and done, we say, he never won a championship. No, he's won it twice, and he's gone to the NBA Finals 6 consecutive years. Hell, one of the best dynasties in football. I think a lot of people are finally starting to embrace it as a dynasty. The Buffalo Bills getting to the Super Bowl 4 consecutive years. Now, they didn't win any, but they got there 4 consecutive years. That's a dynasty because it's tough to do, and you'll probably never see that again in this day and age with free agency. So I wish that LeBron would get a little bit more positive pub for getting to 6 straight NBA Finals and not being a James Jones on the bench, not being a role player or, a contributor. He's the leader of a team that has gone 6 consecutive seasons. And, again, it's up there with Magic getting to the Finals 9 times in 12 years. It's very, very impressive, and I don't think he's getting enough pub for it. And it's something that we'll appreciate when he's no longer playing, and that's unfortunate. So please appreciate that right now because it's unheard of.
You just hit my response right on the head. We're not going to appreciate it until he's no longer on the court anymore. And it's just unfortunate. I just feel like if you're still questioning LeBron James as an all-time great at this stage, if you're allowing your insecurity of as a fan of another player or potentially another era or whatever the case may be to impact your judgment when with what you're seeing out there on the court. Well, then that's just going to be your loss. For the rest of us, we're going to enjoy and certainly appreciate what we've got before us. All right, and for my final shot, I'm going to take it back to Muhammad Ali one more time and just describe what his life meant to me. Basically, that's to be unapologetic in your convictions and in defending the things that you hold dear, and about maintaining that unwavering desire when attempting to accomplish your goals. So that's the lesson I took from his life and will always hold on to when I think of Muhammad Ali. For Jameson Welsh and Jordan Buscarini, I am Jabari Davis, and this has been another episode of your Triple Threat Podcast. Be sure to tune in next week as we'll be joined by longtime NBA writer and historian Roland Lazenby, as he now has a huge Kobe Bryant project set to be released in October, as well as Alex Kennedy of Basketball Insiders to continue discussing these NBA finals. Thank you.
Thank you.